Okay, we have another episode of the Vela News Podcast. I'm Fred Dreyer. I am joined by Kaylee Fretz. Kaylee, I want you to set the scene for us right now. Where are we? What the heck is going on here?
We're behind the building at some sort of shooting range.
Yeah, it's a shooting range.
It's where we've been put for the day's press room. We're currently standing, I think this is an AC unit that we've put the microphones on.
Very glamorous.
And we're just hanging out back here because it's a little bit windy everywhere else.
Yeah. The Vela News Podcast studio today is probably the most glamorous it's ever been. It's literally like behind a weird building at a shooting range.
Yep. Very strange.
Somewhere in California, because we're out here for the Amgen Tour of California. The second stage just finished up in San Jose. It was a thrilling stage won by Rafael Majka.
For good and bad reasons.
Good and bad reasons. It was won by Rafael Majka. The most dramatic moment of the day and a real huge bummer came on the descent off of Mount Hamilton when Tom Squeans, our fan favorite of the podcasts, Tom Squeans crashed very hard, suffered a broken collarbone and a concussion. Kind of a scary moment. It was not a good look for the sport.
Yeah, really strange crash too. Kind of came into it and just lost the front wheel. And when that happens and you have all the weight over the front end, you just sort of dive forward and he smacked his head pretty good, tore his jersey off. And then the kind of weird bit was that the neutral service came up and checked his bike, like neutral service does. You know, their mechanics, they're mostly concerned with the bicycle. Bicycle was okay. Handed him back his bike, and he sort of stumbled around and then tried to get on and stumbled some more.
It looked bad.
He was very, very clearly had a head injury. Definitely should not have been getting back on a bike.
It was reminiscent of those, like, 90s NFL football videos where somebody, they say, he got his bell rung because he tackled someone so hard and is staggering around. I mean, it was bad. Yeah. It was a bad look. Got back on his bike, rode for a little while, and then eventually was taken off his bike. And this was an interesting moment for you and myself, because we happened to be with the Cannondale JPEG team boss, Jonathan Vodders, at the time, recording an episode of the Vela News show.
Inside the Cannondale bus.
When this all went down, and Vodders was feverishly trying to get in touch with his team directors on the road to basically pull Tom's off the bike.
Yeah, and it was basically is an issue of cell coverage. Yeah. So the directors, you know, watching on television, it makes it seem maybe less chaotic than it actually is. Sometimes, you know, the director wasn't in the right place. The director didn't even know where Tom's was.
Yeah.
Had to go find him, physically get him off his bike. I mean, that's the thing about these riders is they really don't want... They don't want to stop riding. And you just had a head injury. You're not necessarily thinking all that clearly. So Tom's is just, you know, continuing on his merry way and really need to get off the bike. So they did finally get through to the Cannondale director, Tom Southam, and Tom pulled him off the bike and off the road.
Right. Yeah, it's going to be a story that we follow going forward, because I think there's a lot of interesting components to this. Everything from head injuries and proper protocols to when do you say no to a rider. And so stay tuned to VelaNews.com, because I can guarantee we're going to have more coverage around that. But we need to talk about the show in general. We are talking about the Tour of California men's race. We're going to be talking about the wrap-up of the women's Amgen Tour of California breakaway from heart disease empowered by SRAM. And we also have to get to the Giro d'Italia, because we had bonkers action go on
Blockhouse.
Stage 9 of Blockhouse. That's right. Everyone's been talking about it on the interwebs. We had the parked motorcycle on the side of the road that took out the whole race.
And Team Sky.
Just the most Giro of Giro things happened.
Yeah. Maybe we'll start with Giro, since chronologically that one kind of came first.
Yep.
So Giro Stage 9, sort of the first major mountain test since Etna, and Mount Etna on Stage 4, definitely the headwind kind of kept that from being as exciting as we were hoping for. Blockhouse was certainly exciting. So 14.2 kilometers to go, and a police motorcycle, parked on the side of the road, not all the way off the road, on a very, very fast section. According to Chad Haga, who saw the whole thing and narrowly avoided it, it was a sort of a downhill right-hand corner situation, and they couldn't see the moto until the last second, and they couldn't take their hands off the bars to point at it or anything like that. All they could do was yell, is what Chad said. And it was clipped by one of the Sunweb riders, who then went flying into the peloton and took out a number of team sky riders who are all riding together, including Garrett Thomas, who apparently may have briefly dislocated his shoulder or something like that.
It was ugly. It was one of those. It was one of those like agony of defeat, wide world of sports clips where
really
you
bad.
Just watch it over and over again. You're like, oh God, I'm so glad I'm not a professional cyclist.
So Thomas lost 5 minutes. Yates lost 5 minutes. Those are the two major losers. And then the race kept going up the road, and that was sort of a source of a bit of contention.
Yeah, it was. Well, should we throw it to our men on the ground?
I think we should.
Andrew Hood is in Italy following the entire race, and I believe he linked up with Rupert Guinness to have a little bit of a debate about whether or not Team Movistar should have kept the pace going. So let's hear from the boys.
Buonasera from Foligno. We are here at a terrazza, partaking in the tradition of aperitivo. Crowd keeps getting bigger. Set the scene for us here. Where are we? What are you looking at? What are you seeing?
Well, look, the stage start is right, just like probably about 50 metres, 70 metres up from where we're sitting now, Andy. And, you know, this town is, it was here last year at the same time. So just from that point of view, this town has been very lucky to have the Giro come here twice within a year. And tomorrow's stage, well, the stage, the time trial is going to be a very important stage. So, you know, it's going to be a great atmosphere once these little streets, these nooks and crannies, they're going to be crammed with riders not just warming up. They're going to be trying to find their way to the start. You don't want to get lost here in Foligno if you're a rider and missed your time, you know, your scheduled time, because there's going to be crowds, there's going to be noise, there's going to be, you know, there's a lot of potential hazards there before you even start the time trial.
Noise and Italia are synonymous, we have discovered. Yesterday, a lot of fireworks, you know, that crash on the run into the blockhouse, you know, I think really kind of marked this Giro. There was a big debate, of course. In that situation, do you wait or do you race? Of course, there was a motorcycle on the edge of the course. Sky and Ulrika were really the biggest victims, plus Kelderman went down. You know, Rupe, you were up there. We were up there at the summit yesterday, the finish line. You talked to Matt White, sports director Ulrika Scott. He was quite vehement that he thought that the race should have stopped at that moment.
Yes, he certainly was. He, you know, Matt White didn't. He wasn't shy about lobbing the hand grenade there. You know, he, you know, first he spoke about the, you know, his you know, sort of frustration about Adam Yates' time loss and the circumstance with the motorbike. But then, certainly his persona or his sentiment shifted very suddenly when he spoke about what he thought was the unsporting behaviour of Movistar, because he felt that at that time Movistar riders would have known that there were three or four Grand Tour contenders on the deck, as he said, and he felt that there was enough time that they should have slowed down to allow them to at least get up and at least find out whether they're fit to race or not, and then continue on. And he said several times after that he felt it was totally you know, it wasn't within the realms of sportsmanlike behaviour, and it was wrong. He did say he does really respect the Movistar team, but he said he felt today, as in yesterday, they made a bad decision.
Yes, you can understand. I think the only reason why there is a debate in this situation from yesterday was the fact that it was an incident that was beyond the normal racing paradigm, in the sense of it was an obstacle from a motorbike that shouldn't have been there caused the crash. It wasn't like a rider error or a crash. Like last year, Kwiatkowski in the pink jersey crashed into the snowbank. And a lot of people said you should wait. In that situation, I was like, no, the race is on. In fact, yesterday, I think the race is on. I think it's impossible to stop the race, even in that situation where it was an outside influence kind of causing the crash, as opposed to just, you know, a pile up in the bunch. But I'm in the old school camp. When the race is on, you don't stop the race. Okay, if it's like 30 Ks into a race, yeah, you can stop. Okay, guys, let's get up. Let's keep rolling. But even then, sometimes it's not right to stop, because a lot of these small teams are trying to get in the breakaway. So you stop the race, then the breakaway doesn't go, and then the small teams lose their chance, even in that situation. So I think almost all the time, especially in the, like yesterday, Movistar was ramping it up. It was a sprint to the base of the blockhouse yesterday. To me, you don't stop the race.
Yeah, look, I see your point there, Andy. But, you know, and there is a fine... we're talking about a very fine line here. I think we agree on that point. There's a very fine line. But Movistar, you know, had set a... You know, they had dictated the race, you know, out to that point. But you got to also realise that Orica Scott, had also... Svein Tuft was at the front there, you know, leading in, you know, into that. But so Orica Scott had committed as well. They did. They was putting their fair share of work into that tempo to contribute to Movistar's work. And I also think that, so that's probably part of Matt White's frustration, that they were chipping into the workload. Now, the other thing I just want to say is that with Movistar, look, they're a cutthroat team. They're a ruthless team. And I say that with compliment as much as the question of whether that fine edge, what is ruthlessness and what is just tipping over, the, you know, pushing the envelope too far. I tend to think they're very...
I know where you're going with this.
I think they'd make very good postmen, put it that way. And I don't mean it in that sense of, in America, that US post. I just mean it, you know that they're pushing it to a certain degree. And I also think there's a little pattern there, because a couple of years ago, 2014, in the Giro, when Nairo Quintana was in the breakaway and coming down the Gavia, they pulled the red flag out and Nairo said, "I didn't see the red flag."
No lo he visto.
Yes, everyone else saw the red flag. And I just wonder, you know, how much does he play on that edge of the envelope, of pushing the envelope of the interpretation of the circumstance around him at the time?
Well, it is an interesting line that we're seeing in the kind of the modern peloton. You know, the riders, they're a lot nicer to each other than they kind of used to be. We don't see this ruthless kind of rivalries, you know, back in the day where guys would literally just hate each other in the peloton and they would, you know, do treacherous things to each other to try just to win. And today, I mean, it's much more PC. You're seeing even the sprinters all, you know, "Hey, nice win there, buddy," on Twitter. And Nairo is old school still, man. He's like, he's going to win. And I mean, he's not breaking the rules. Well, you know, you could say he's breaking some standards of conduct. You know, that's debatable. Look, he's here to win.
Look, he's pushing the rules. Put it that way. He's probably racing. He's probably using the rules to his service, and that's okay. Look, I'm not saying what him and the team are doing is illegal, but one thing that they could have done, if they had of say, for example, said, "Hey, look, three contenders are on the deck here. Ease up." If he had to order them to ease up just for a couple of minutes, just to find out, because they would have found it. And you know what? He could have had extra class to the panache he already has. Everyone knows he's the strongest rider here.
Yeah, but how hard is it to stop the race when you're at that moment and your adrenaline's up and these guys are, you know, they have the whole stage plan to stop that race, to slow way down and then just start up again at the start of the climb? I don't know, man. I don't think that would be, I think, very hard to do. And plus, be potentially it could backfire. You know, they might lose the whole momentum of the climb, and then you lose your opportunity. They've been working for the whole Giro. I mean, they've been planning this tactical move since 6 months ago. Look, but anyway, we got to wrap it up here, guys. Okay, go ahead.
I just think you can be a badass racer and also have a bit of class. That's as well, a lot of class.
All right, we'll leave it with that. Anyway, we'll hopefully catch up to you guys. Check in again here from the Giro d'Italia. Grazie mille.
Grazie.
Okay, Kaylee, what's your take? Should they have waited?
No.
No?
No, they should not wait. Yeah. No, I mean, I get that the sportsmanlike thing to do is maybe to make sure everyone's okay. But in a moment like that, when the race is on and you know, Movistar doesn't know who fell down.
No.
They don't know how bad the injuries are. You know, if every single time there's a crash anywhere near the finish of one of these bike races, the entire thing is neutralized, then that changes the face of pro cycling.
Right.
Let's be honest. And I don't think it changes it necessarily in the way that we want it to be changed. Pro cycling is a pretty badass sport, and I don't think we want to go down that road towards sort of soccer falling on the ground, holding your ankle.
Wow,
kind of nonsense.
You're saying flopping. Oh my God, hot take. Crashing with a moto is a flop. No, I'm with you. Look, I think that so long as there's not a race vehicle in the front waving a red flag telling everyone to stop, there's always going to be the motivation to push on, and you can't really argue with that motivation to push on. You know, the arguments that I was hearing made for why they should have stopped was that, well, three GC guys were crashed. You know, when you have your head down and you're going as hard as you can and you hear a crash behind you, you don't know that three GC guys have crashed.
No.
You just know that someone has crashed.
I think the only situation, as you said, the two situations where you would stop a race like this is if there's a car with a red flag, or if the pink jersey is on the ground. Yep. And that's a pretty clear unwritten rule within cycling that you do not keep going when the leader is on the ground. But that's a very specific instance, and pink was definitely still riding.
So Giro GC battle looks like it is Nairo Quintana is in the lead. Tom Dumoulin, he's right there. I thought that Nairo's going to need to take at least a minute out of him on the Blockhouse stage in order to really feel comfortable about having Tommy Dean Herrera's, and he only took 30 seconds out. So I almost see that stage win as a bit of a loss for Nairo.
You know, I disagree with that a little bit. I think that Tom staying close, particularly right now, could actually work out in Quintana's favor, because I think that Dumoulin will take the pink jersey on Tuesday in the time trial. I think that he can take that much time on Quintana. And that just means that Sunweb has to defend the pink jersey for a week until that really gnarly final week of the Giro. Nairo doesn't necessarily want pink in this week. He wants pink in the last week. So this could actually end up saving the legs of his team a little bit and work out, I think, in his favor, because I think he'll take it back since we get into the big mountains anyway.
Yeah, but what about Dumoulin? I mean, the thing that really blew me away was how well he did that Blockhouse climb. He let the other guys go with the accelerations. He's a big diesel. He almost rode it like a bottom-to-top time trial. Mm-hmm. And when you have that steady, powerful rhythm and you're not going and worrying about the accelerations, you know, you can make up time on people when they slow down. So I don't know if that's going to translate to something like the Mortirolo Stelvio Day, but we'll see. I mean, if he's climbing that well, maybe Nairo needs a little more time on him.
He's looking really, really lean right now, and he looks like a different rider than even a year ago. And I think that he will be climbing better than we expect him to. But that also means that he might not be time trialing as well as we expect him to. Maybe he won't be able to take quite as much time as peak of his time trial powers, Tom Dumoulin.
Do you think Tom Dumoulin's a hungry man?
I think he's probably a hungry man.
Yeah. This whole trip, we've been joking about the hungry man, because Kaylee over here is a hungry man. He needs to eat all the time.
Yep. I'm pretty much constantly hungry. Right. I'm not a hangry person, though. That's an important distinction. I don't get cranky when I'm hungry. I just get hungry when I'm hungry.
Well, I think crankiness is a great segue into our next segment of the podcast, because we need to talk about the Amgen Tour California women's race. Breakaway from cancer, empowered by SRAM, powered by
breakaway from gingivitis,
powered by PBR. We need to talk about this race because it was aggressive. It was exciting. It came down to a battle of seconds between Anna van der Breggen of Bulls Dolmans and Katie Hall of UHC. And Kaylee, we got some drama.
We got some drama.
We got some bona fide, like,
cussing
at people, elbowing, shoving. We got some some good drama to talk about here. We have a rivalry.
We have definitely a rivalry. You get these things a lot when big European squads come back into the U.S. I mean, we've heard about it at races like the Pro Challenge, you know, where the big teams would just sort of push little guys like Jelly Belly around, and it's kind of it's not quite the same in the women's field, but it's a similar dynamic. So Bulls comes in. They have the Olympic gold medalist. They're up against, you know, who are these blue upstarts floating around? Like,
totally. They're like, hey, you were racing a bike for the first time 3 years ago. I've been racing since I was 12.
Exactly. So when it was down to just 3 seconds between Katie Hall and van der Breggen, we had that intermediate sprint
Saturday. This was stage three.
Yeah, so stage two was a queen stage. It was a 3 second gap after that, and there's no more climbing. So there's no more opportunity to take seconds naturally.
Yeah.
There are only bonus seconds. And basically, van der Breggen's teammate, Christine Majerus, sort of gave Katie Hall's teammate, Ruth Winder, a bit of a flick coming into an intermediate sprint. Ruth was charged with taking bonus seconds in that sprint, and essentially she was pushed. I shouldn't. She ended up off the road. It's unclear whether it was an intentional thing or not.
We've looked at the Zapruder film a few times and inconclusive, but we do know that she ended up in the dirt with unclipped going outrigger, full on leg out.
Yeah, and some of the riders that were behind said that they thought it was an intentional thing. Ruth was very cagey when I talked to her and wouldn't say either way. And obviously, Bulls defends themselves, so it's a classic sort of she said, kind of situation.
Although we did have eyes on the ground. seeing Ruth like tossing some nasty foul
language
their way.
Well, what this turned into was just sort of a war of words and maybe a couple elbows in the remaining stage and a half. Yeah. And after the finish on Sunday, there was cussing and basically right after the finish line, a bunch of Bulls women kind of standing around celebrating their victory, which they had just earned. And Ruth and I think one of her teammates sort of rolled by, and allegedly there were words said in UHC's direction right at the finish line by Bulls. Ruth then came over and said, "Hey, if you want to say something, say it to my face." And we had, you know, general sort of angry chatter.
Angry.
I don't know the way to say it.
Here's the thing. This shows that, like, all these women really want to win this race. They're aggressive. They're competitive. They have a lot of emotion. They've been training for this thing, and they take it really seriously. Hot take here. I like it. I really like it.
I agree.
I think, first of all, I like this format. I like having a race that comes down to this battle of seconds between the world's best international squad and the plucky upstart American team. That's a great storyline. But second of all, I like the fact that these women take this so seriously and are so competitive and wanting to do it that they're throwing elbows, man. They're getting emotional and they want it. I don't know. I really enjoyed following the women's race.
Yep. No, I totally agree. I think that stuff like this, you know, every once in a while when you write a story like we wrote on Monday morning, you get accused of sort of tabloid journalism. I would fight back against that and say that, you know, these are interesting stories. They are relevant stories. This is sport. Sport is all about competition. That doesn't have to just be, you know, finish lines. That can also be sort of battle of will in many other ways. And I think that like you said, this proves that that women's racing can be just as exciting and aggressive as anything else.
Oh, it was more so than the men's racing.
Way better than
we
didn't even pay attention to the men's race yesterday.
Oh, God. Women were just, they were so aggressive. I was really, really pleased to see that. Before we get to talking about today's stage, Kaylee, you know, I saw a lot of people out there riding their bicycles. A lot of fit people in this part of the world, Northern California.
Tons of fit people.
Well, you know, do you have some advice for fit people? I mean, we ride our bikes. We're fit people. We have a little little secret for these fit people about life insurance.
Yes, correct. Well, the VeloNews podcast is once again sponsored by Health IQ, which is a life insurance company that has essentially taken into account the fact that you are a much more healthy person than the average American.
Yeah.
And you get lower rates as a result. So you can head on over to healthiq.com/VeloNews and get yourself a quote.
Do you think they will still offer me the healthy man quote after this week? I know we've been eating a lot of press room food, not a lot of bike riding.
Big old plate of lasagna just now.
Yeah, maybe a couple beers after work. I don't know if I'm going to qualify.
I think that after this week, we will almost certainly not qualify for at least a little while.
Well, we better go on their website now.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on. We need to talk about stage two. I think a lot of us came into today's stage two, which went up and over Mount Hamilton, finished in San Jose. It's a stage we've done before, almost identical to the 2015 stage. I think a lot of us looked at this as a day, okay, maybe a Sagan, a fast finisher who can make it over the climbs, but not necessarily a day for the GC guys. And boy, were we surprised, because they dropped a bomb. GC guys dropped a bomb on Mount Hamilton today.
Kind of, yeah. And it was GC guys. I think Rafael Micah, who ended up winning the stage, is a definite contender for the overall. But when I have spoken to riders like George Bennett and Ian Boswell, who are also in that group, they weren't necessarily domestiques, but they were not. George Bennett in particular, who has Robert Hessink here.
Right.
Was not necessarily sort of the team leader. And so I think that move was almost just sort of trying to set up something later. But it ended up working out. And you had four super strong riders off the front: Rafa Micah, Ian Boswell, George Bennett, and Lachlan Morton. And they just never came back. They stretched that lead over a minute. And behind them, Cannondale was the only team chasing.
Yeah.
It was mostly Nate Brown on the front, just pinning it for Andrew Talansky. And yeah, BMC had Brent Bookwalter back there, but BMC didn't really put anything into the chase, and that gap just never came back.
So we spoke with a number of riders after the stage today, both guys who were in the break, guys who missed the break, and the picture that I came away with was, as the group was approaching the base of the climb, it was actually Lotto Jumbo that went on the front and just freaking nuked it. And Bennett was yelling at the guys to go faster, 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 faster. And Ben King said, "Ooh, that's when he knew something was wrong." Mm-hmm. Lachlan sprung across, was able to make that group. Bookwalter, he said, actually, we can hear from him right now. He basically said that like he raced with his legs, not his heart.
Compared to years past going up Hamilton, what was it like this year? Faster, slower, what, more aggressive, less aggressive?
You know, I think it's all relative. And I think the positive takeaway is that I'm a better rider and a stronger rider now than I was last time I went up it. I think last time I went up it, I was still progressing to the point where trying to make a group of 30 at a race of this level was really a big ride and a really good day for me. Whereas now, I'm holding myself to a higher standard, and you know, I definitely expect myself to be there in that group, and even when it gets smaller. So, yeah, physically I felt good and I felt strong, and in hindsight, probably rode with my head a little too much and not enough with the heart and legs. Well, got to look at the results from today, take stock, see where we're at, see who finished where. Definitely would have preferred not to have, you know, conceded the time we did to those four guys up the road. But, we got two unpredictable stages, I think, in the next 2 days. And then, the Rock'em Sock'em Showdown at Baldy, and then a real decisive time trial. So definitely, looking at the caliber of riders that are up there, you don't want to ever be trying to fight back that kind of time. But it's still possible, and we're going to give it a go.
Yeah, it was interesting to hear him say that. And then the other guy, who curiously missed that move, Andrew Talansky. Now you spoke with Talansky, correct?
I did speak with Talansky. Caught up with him at the Cannondale bus after the finish, and he basically admitted that he made a mistake. Let's listen in. That move on Hamilton, did you see that go, decide not to go? What exactly went down there?
Yeah, you make decisions on the fly in bike racing, and, now I can sit here and tell you I made, a wrong tactical decision, but it was a conscious choice not to go with it. I thought it had the potential to be a little bit like Tour of Utah. The final stage was for me last year. 50K to go, a lot of headwind towards the finish, maybe a little bit of energy not so well spent. Knew we also had Tom's up there. I didn't really want to fully activate the race again. That said, sitting here now, I can tell you it was the wrong thing, but just as easily could have gone the other way.
Yeah. Just chatting with Nate, he said, you think you have good legs looking ahead to Baldy and time trial, or are you confident you can claw back some of that time?
Yeah, I mean, I think a stage like Mount Baldy, I felt comfortable on this climb today. Obviously, we never went full gas or anywhere near it, but I think the stage of Mount Baldy has potential to be a very intense overall day. Kind of, if raced in the right way, comparative to the stage Contador, created one of the most exciting stages of the Vuelta on the way to Formigal, 3 hours, full gas. Baldy has the potential to be the same. 30 seconds, whatever it is, 37 can seem like a fair bit. I think that kind of climbing day suits me more. Finishing up a little bit at higher altitude suits me. And then, honestly, the time trial is kind of the ace in the pocket. Yeah. So if I can get some of that time back, or all of it, on Baldy, and then, do a good ride in the TT, I still think, the podium's very well within reach, but I still think the win's within reach.
Still in it to win it.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ben. Appreciate it.
Wow, that's interesting to hear him say that. I mean, I picked Andrew Talansky to win this race outright. I don't think his shot, I don't think he's totally blown his shot, but, it's going to be more difficult for him now.
No, at the end there, they've gone back, and I think he's done the math, and I think he can take a lot of the time back on Baldy, and then he's probably the best time trialist that's up near the top of the standings. So I do think it's still possible that Talansky walks away with a victory at the Tour of California, but definitely did not make it easy on himself today.
So we have an American in the mix.
Yeah, we do.
Ian Boswell, a guy who's been sort of he's been waiting in the wings for a number of years. He's been like the lone weird American on Team Sky. There's always that weird American. It used to be Danny Pate.
Yep.
Now it's the Boz. And I think he has as good a shot as anyone now to win this race. Now, you caught up with the Boz?
I did catch up with the Boz.
What do you have to say?
Well, so he came into this race, again, not as sort of the sole leader of his Team Sky squad. They have a couple different guys that can do something, and they're also just here to win stages with Elia Viviani. So today, even after today, I asked him straight up, are you now the sort of the team leader of the team? And he didn't really would not say yes to that question. And then I also asked him about Tom Squinch, who had that super gnarly crash. Asked him a little bit about his own head injuries, because Ian Boswell's had a couple of his own head injuries. Nope. And how that sort of, even in the last couple of years, things have changed in terms of the treatment of head injuries in races like this. So let's listen in to Ian.
I say it's a bad team, but you know, we have to take advantage of days like today. And you know, we didn't really know how it would go down, but once it kind of kicked off, then we just had to be there. And you know, between myself, Pete Kenna, good job, Elliot. Thanks, man. Yeah, between the GC guys, you know, one of us had to mark the move, and I just happened to be there and felt good. And at the end of the day, it's kind of cool to ride with those guys again. You know, George, I raced with him on Livestrong. Lachlan, you know, we raced together quite a bit at, you know, when he was with JV at Slipstream, and I was on Bissell at Tour Utah. Mike, you know, raced with once in a while, but to be honest, between the four of us, it was actually a really cohesive and productive group. I mean, oftentimes you get a group like that, and okay, we kind of messed around the last 800 meters, but other than that, you know, no one missed a turn. Everyone was, you know, honest, working, and it's good to see.
Yeah. You, when we chatted the other day, you said you weren't really sure what to expect out of this week. I mean, you know, like you said, you don't really have a single protected rider. Does this put you into that role?
I guess with maybe, I don't know what the time gap was at the end, but
50, I think.
Yeah, but you know, I'm like, obviously, I've never really, especially at this level, put out a good time trial. So having a little buffer room is good, but you know, we'll see what happens on Baldy as well. And you know, we still have Viviani here, and you know, for myself, it'd still be nice for him to win a stage. You know, it's still a World Tour race, so it doesn't mean like I'm just going to sit in and not try to help out for the lead out. So you know, every day we have an opportunity to try to win a stage. So whether it's, you know, mountain stage, time trial, or sprint stage, you know, we'll be a team.
Obviously, legs feeling pretty good today. What are you expecting on Baldy? I mean, are you expecting to be able to climb with the front guys?
We'll see. You know, still a few days away, and you know, today I felt good on Hamilton. I was actually surprised because George went, Lachlan went, and I just kind of sprinted a little bit, and sure enough, I was right there with him, and that was the gap. And obviously, Mike is, you know, a seasoned veteran. He came across without much issue, but that's a different day as well because it's a lot more climbing, and you know, we're at altitude. It's longer climbs. You have to ride, you know, a bit more your own pace. But no, I felt comfortable today. But no, I mean, there's some strong guys like, you know, George and Micah, even Lachlan. You know, once you're on those flats and stuff, I was like, oh, these guys are strong. You know, so just making sure to not do too much.
Did you see any of the Tom Squinch incident?
I did. I was actually behind, like, all the descents. I mean, I came off that bad crash 3 weeks ago, so, you know, obviously I don't want to get dropped on the downhill, but I don't want to, like, take crazy risks. And this descent was treacherous last time we did it. So I was behind him, and that's why I was behind him, because I didn't want to take any risks. I figure, you know, maybe from the TV it looks like I'm burning extra energy, but, you know, you just kind of, if you just sit, you know, 50 meters behind, you can kind of see how those guys are braking and ride your own pace on the downhill. I don't know what happened. It was a straight road, like kind of gradually bending left, and looks like his front tire just busted out, or I don't know if a rock got caught in his front wheel, but yeah, he went down pretty hard. And he's such a nice guy, like, yeah, I feel really bad for him, because, and he's won the stages last time as well, and it's a good finish for him. So,
have you ever dealt with concussion stuff before? Any bad head injuries?
Oh yeah, I've had a lot of concussions. 2010, before Tour de l'Avenir, I was unconscious for 5 minutes, and Ben King went back to get the director, and I still raced the next day. It was so bad that I was like unconscious, and I didn't wake up until they came back for me. I'd like carve out my helmet just to fit it over my head because my ear was so swollen. And I've had multiple other concussions as well. So it's something that at the time, though, you don't really think about. When you're a young U23 rider, I was like, well, I have to do this race. It wasn't even in the question to skip the race.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like you basically have to be protected from yourself. I mean, Tom's was pulled out of the race today by a director. Do you have a concussion protocol here?
Yeah, so we do now with our team doctors, but that's one thing that... You know, at this level, like, the doctors on our team are looking after our health and making sure we're healthy. But like you said, the rider usually wants to keep going. It's hard for the team to, well, it's hard for a rider to, like, not want to race, because as riders, we want to race. So it's up to whether it's the medical staff or the UCI or someone to just say, you know, there's a concussion protocol that riders can't race if they have a concussion or even potential symptoms of a concussion.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think now Boswell, I'm saying it, I'm doing it. He's going to win this race. He's my pick. I mean, he knows how to time trial. He can climb.
Sort of. Yeah. I mean, as we just heard, he's not totally confident in his time trial, but it's not terrible either. He's one of those guys that has never really had to time trial, honestly. Right. Like, if you're not a GC favorite and you're not a time trialist, you use time trials and stage races as recovery days. Like, all you want to do is make time cut, and that's always what he's done. I don't think he has any idea what he can do in a time trial.
Interesting. Hey, do you have any Cat 3 type advice for time trialing? Because I do.
I'm not a Cat 3, Fred. I'm not allowed to. You can't ask me.
So my Cat 3 advice for time trialing is even more ridiculous because I was also a triathlete for a number of years.
Oh, no.
So I'd say that, you know, you got a big time trial coming up and you want to win the race. Fish that time trial bike out of the garage like the night before.
Oh, yeah.
You know, throw the clip-on bars on, maybe roll it around the driveway. You're good to go, man. You should be fine. And if you're a triathlete, Cat 3, maybe think about taking off that bento box and the weird water bladder that attaches to the rear of the bike, because I don't think that's UCI legal.
But do not put sleeves on. Sleeves are still banned.
Yeah. Totally go sleeveless. Go in the race kit.
It's way faster. I mean, like, bare skin, way faster than... Yeah, sure.
Yeah, the other thing is for time trial, just hard as you can go, right out of the gun.
Immediately.
Yeah. Red line. Okay, well, I mean, that's going to be the next test. I mean, we have Baldy, we have the time trial, and that's going to be that race. So let's wrap it up here, Kaylee. We have, for the second segment of the podcast, I think a very interesting interview. We were hanging out in the press room, and Mr. Jonathan Vodders came in. And
looking suave.
Looking lost. Let's admit it. He was super lost. He was like, where's my team bus? And we're like, I don't know, but we're here, and so you need to talk to us.
You need to talk to us now.
Last week, Jonathan had a story about his team in the Wall Street Journal, basically talking about the team's financial breakdown, and I had some serious questions for him after this about the financial state of the team, because it sounded like, you know, he's wanting more sponsors, he's wanting equity partners, needs some more cash, and so we talked with him about the team, his decisions over the last few years. It's a good chat. I think you guys are going to enjoy this one.
Very serious, furrowed brow questions.
Very furrowed. Thanks for tuning in to the Velo News Podcast. I'm Fred Dreyer. I want to set the scene for you right now. I am sitting at a park bench next to a skeet shooting range.
Yeah, trap and skeet.
Trap and skeet. We're out here in the outskirts of San Jose, California, stage 2 of the Amgen Tour California. And I'm sitting across the table from a real veteran of American bike racing.
And trap and skeet shooting.
He did not fly his airplane out here, but did you bring your guns? Did you bring some guns?
No guns. No. Carry-on only.
It is Jonathan Vodders of the Cannondale Drapac Professional Team. Jonathan, we just happened to run into each other at this like shooting range that is also the media center for this stage of the Tour California. And I had a question for you. I wanted to talk about this story that appeared a few days ago in the Wall Street Journal. In the story, you were talking about where Cannondale Drapac is from a financial perspective, wanting to bring on some new sponsors, perhaps some new equity partners. And so I guess a good place to get started is, what was the thrust of the story, and where is the team at from a business perspective right now?
Well, the thrust of the story was quite simply that if we want to get back to being one of the more competitive World Tour teams, we have to reinforce our finances.
Yep.
And that's the pure and simple answer. It's not simply a matter of just going out and buying better riders. It's also that because of the incredibly inflationary rider market over the past 6 or 7 years. In order for us to, you know, even pay the guys that we have fair market value, we've had to make a lot of cuts in stuff like aerodynamics and training camps and physiology and just support that, that, you know, young up and coming riders need. And we got to change that. We need, it's not that we need to go and buy Peter Sagan, but we do need to support the talent that we have a whole lot better. And, you know, then look at bringing on, you know, a few new high dollar pieces of talent. The ownership of the team, Doug, saying that quite simply, is a little tired of scratching. That doesn't mean, you know, that there's anything fatal on the horizon, but I would say all of us are a little bit, I mean, listen, you look at the history of the team, you know, we lost Wiggins to big money. I mean, there are a number of riders that I've, you know, lost in negotiations to just, you know, 5x the paycheck. It's a lot.
Yeah.
And guys that quickly go on to win a lot of races. You know, our team cars have 200,000 kilometers on them. We're just not – even the talent that we have, we are not supporting them – to the level that they deserve. As to say, you know, with Sky as an example, yep. When they want to do an altitude camp, they just rent that hotel on the top of the Taita all year. Like, mm-hmm. They've got at least 5 rooms in that thing, 365. You want to go train in Taita? Go. I can't afford that.
Right.
I can't. Our infrastructure just doesn't support that sort of an arrangement. So we're not, you know, we have one coach on staff. We lost a very crucial member of our team a couple years back, an aerodynamicist that made huge differences in our performance over the years, Robbie Ketchell, mm-hmm. to Sky. And that's just happened over and over and over and over again. So, you know, that's just, it's tiresome, quite frankly. And then it's tiresome that your readers and most cycling fans in general, you know, they just say, oh, well, look, Sky's really awesome. And, you know, BMC, they kick ass or whatever. And, well, these guys aren't so good. What the hell? And, you know, the fact of the matter is we operate on one-third the budget of Sky.
Right.
Well, I think a lot of times people just associate that with personnel. And they say, okay, yeah, you know, someone like Cannondale, a team like Cannondale Drapac has a smaller budget, and that to a certain degree is reflected in personnel, but I know the riders on that team and they're all pretty good. Why can't they win? So to hear you talk about the behind the scenes infrastructure like coaches and training camps and the nuts and bolts, I mean, that brings it a little bit more to life for me.
Well, and also just listen, I have always taken a recruiting strategy to find outsiders that can win big races.
Right.
So could I have taken a recruiting strategy to find, you know, riders that can just knock off a stage win here or there, sort of a second tier sprinter that can snag something once in a while, and up our win count? Sure.
Right.
That isn't beyond our budget. But I've always selected riders, and I'll use, you know, Dylan Van Baarle fourth in Flanders and Sebastian Langeveld third in Roubaix as examples. Dylan may get there someday, but as of right now, he is not a monument winner just yet.
Right.
And Sebastian is a guy who is incredibly astute and knows exactly how to ride those races, but he's also not a monument winner, minus, you know, some extremely lucky things happening for him, right? But those are the type of guys that I look at and go, yeah, but if I take Dylan and Sebastian on the same team and then bring an outsider like Sepp van Marken in, and we can create sort of a strange team dynamic that messes with the race pattern in Roubaix, and all of a sudden we can get a rider, an outsider, to win a monument. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of victory I enjoy. Knocking off a stage of Terreno Adriatico, quite frankly, it's not that I don't see value in that. It's that my experience with global corporations is that that level of a race, to them, winning is less important than, you know, getting a fun sort of story from inside the bus,
right,
after the race. It's, you know, Roubaix is important. Flanders is important. Tour de France, incredibly important. Giro, sort of, also. But, you know, I mean, I can tell you an example of that is when Dan Martin won Liège Bastogne Liège. Mm-hmm. I would say that 95% of the people in Garmin marketing at that point in time didn't. They said, "Oh, well, where is this race?"
Wow!
Because I mean, on our end, we were all like high fiving each other and really excited because you know it's Liège-Bastogne-Liège. It's this
right.
timeless, ageless, humongous monument.
Yeah, which I mean, it's a monument, and of course. But my point is I've always recruited to like you know the Ryder Hegedalls of the world, the Johan van Summerens of the world, the you know the, like this kind of crazy outside pick that if you create a correct team dynamic and you create a correct support structure around them and you pick up a couple little of these advantages like having Robbie Ketchel on staff, like sort of getting every last little detail right, then you sometimes get these upset victories in really big races. Mm-hmm. And that counts for sponsors.
What about the allure of going after GC riders that I wouldn't say are on the downward trajectory but have had a dip in performance? Because I always think about like the NBA model, which is like, you know, you look at the teams that year in, year out are really good, and they're teams that recruit and develop young talent, and they don't go chasing after free agents, and they don't spend a lot of money on flashy hires. And I wouldn't say that your team has had a lot of flashy hires, but I'm thinking of like Pierre Roland and Rigoberto as guys who were team leaders at other teams and, you know, didn't have the performances for a few years and, you know, their contracts were up and you were to get them. But I've always thought, well, why spend the resources on a guy like that versus putting those resources towards guys on the way up?
Well, I mean, we have a lot of guys on the way up.
Yep.
I mean, what you're describing is the two sides of the curve that we operate in. As to say, you know, when Ryder Hegedal won the Giro, he was 32 years old.
Yep.
And, you know, we also operate, I mean, we have the youngest median age of any World Tour team. So we're sort of operating on both sides of that curve. Where we're not operating is in the middle, because that's where, you know, you're Richie Porte, you're Chris Froome, you're Alberto Contador, and so on and so forth. Peter Sagan, the obvious example, Quintana, another obvious example. Those are riders whose compensation level basically is around half of our entire rider payroll. Mm. So that's where we sort of can't touch. So yeah, I'm on the fringes, you know, in my recruiting strategies. And I'm always on the fringes in a way that is thoughtful in that, okay, well, maybe he can take it one step further if we do X, Y, and Z. And I, you know, I push the guys really hard and, you know, and personally coach a lot of them. And sometimes it works really great, like with Dylan and Sebastian. And you know, sometimes they totally explode because they can't handle, you know, trying to push it to the next level because maybe they're just not, you know, of that level. Mm. But that's our model. And that's where we are. And I think, you know, back to your original point, I think it's just, you know, we like that model, but the bifurcation of budget levels in cycling is much more extreme than it was in 2010.
Right.
Much more extreme. And it's just tiresome at this point in time. You know, it was fun when you were a $10 million team beating a $20 million team. That was cool. That was fun. Now it's like, oh, $40 million? Okay, let's just concentrate on a different race or a different, you know, or whatever. Like it's just, it is overwhelming. And it's really overwhelming, you know, when it comes to the transfer market and right. that when you hear of guys that you'd really like, to take on, it's just, you're not even in the ball game. I mean, a funny story with that is in 2011, I had been talking to Chris from before the Vuelta that he sort of came out in and, you know, I was kicking the tires, but I wasn't getting it done. And then he went to the Vuelta, and I said, I think, okay. By the end of week one, of course, he was, you know, in the leader's jersey, I think, or maybe, I don't know. Anyway, and by the end of it, there you go. It was one of those things where I had actually anticipated the market. I didn't move on it fast enough. Brailsford had actually said, we don't have the budget to sign you at 100,000 euros or something like that, right? We don't have the budget to sign you. I'm sorry. You know, see you later. And in that 1 month period, it went from, we don't have the budget to sign you to, here's a 2 million euro contract. I don't have that flexibility.
You don't have that flexibility. Yeah. Nope. You don't have the power to do that. Yeah.
It's just like nowhere even close. So it was just like, you know, the discussions with Chris Froome and his agent went from, let me think about this, to congratulations on your new contract with Sky.
Right.
And that's it.
Yeah. You all the Ryanair tickets on Ryanair and cars with 300,000 kilometers on them.
Right.
Not gonna bring Chris Froome to the team.
No. And listen, I'm not complaining at all. But nonetheless, you know, the story in the Wall Street Journal was, hey, if somebody wants to step in here, you know, we can do a hell of a lot better job than we are doing, but we need some resources to make that work.
Was it a story though of, hey, if someone doesn't step in, we're not going to be around?
I mean, listen, Dre Pack is 100% supportive. Cannondale is 100% supportive. I mean, that decision ultimately rests with Doug, as it does every year.
Right.
You know, I mean, like I said, it's really up to him, but I think that's putting it a little bit in an extreme standpoint.
Okay.
I mean, we have a lot of good funding. I think we just really like to get back in the real game is really what it comes down to.
Well, I wanted to ask you that because there was part of me that read that story and thought, oh, you know, is this some canary in the coal mine type moment where, you know, because I could tell that the motivation was out there to bring on partners, but I just didn't know whether that was a thing of like, if we don't bring on a partner, I'm going to be, you know, flying people around in my airplane as a business next year.
that is not a very good business. yeah, I mean,
weed tourism, fly people in from out of state to Colorado.
That's I got a funny story with you about Floyd and that, but anyway, that's but yeah, strictly speaking, delivering marijuana in an airplane, even inside the state of Colorado, is illegal. So just
yes, of course, we're here on the Villainous Podcast. We're here on the Villainous Podcast. Like to keep everything above board. But now the question of, you know, whether this was a make it or break it moment for the team. It sounds like that's not the case.
I mean, we hit a make it or break it moment every single year of our existence.
Right.
But that wasn't the purpose of this article, no.
Okay.
This was a, hey, let's try to scare up some support. And we knew that when we put that out there that it was that, you know, some people were going to go, oh, wait a minute, you know, and make a couple riders nervous and whatever else. But that's, I mean, end of the day, that was anticipated. But yeah, I mean, cycling, listen, it's a make it, I mean, for the teams that aren't Sky, it is a make it or make it proposition every single year. And whether people realize that or not, you know, that's a different story. I mean, the closest we've ever come to not, and nobody even knows about this, is it was like a couple days before Christmas in 2011. And we get a call from this guy, a distressed private equity investor in Toronto, that says, hey,
The Finches in the background are loving this story, by the
way. But anyway, he gives us this call and says, hey, you know, heads up. You know, I loaned Cervelo some money and, you know, they haven't been able to make the payments. And so I'm going to own Cervelo, you know, a couple of days. And, you know, like, I don't think this team's very good investment for Cervelo. Now, that was, it was about 4 days before Christmas, 4 or 5 days. And had that happened, we could not have survived. Like, it was, the financial hit was big enough that we would have just had to fold the whole thing. Mm-hmm. It did not matter that Garmin was there and everything else. Like, there are all these pieces of the puzzle, and one of them falls off. Whether because they had an out in the contract, or whether because they became insolvent, or whether because they got bought and sold, or whatever, it's irrelevant. Like, one of those pieces falls out. You cannot... There's no way to adjust. Mm-hmm. Mm. Unlike most businesses where, you know, you can pull back a little bit of cost here and there. The cycling team, you know, 60-70% of your cost is rider salary. It's fixed. And so it's essentially a binary equation. Do you exist? Do you not exist? And, you know, so like I said, we face that every single year. This article is more of a, hey, we'd like to not face this every single year.
Right. You know, I'm thinking back to a conversation you and I had. Oh, this must have been 2010 or 11 when I was working for the Sports Business Journal writing about the business model of
putting on pro races, and we were talking about the business model of patronage in cycling and how, especially in the team model, it, at that point in time, I think it was like 50-50 or maybe 60-40 of teams that had basically had a business model of patronage,
right,
of sugar daddy backstopping it. Where would you put that today?
So first thing I want to say, by the way, is that Cervelo got bought by somebody else at the last minute.
Yeah.
And they ended up being our sponsor for a few more years, and they were great. So, like, I don't want to – it was just this, like – it was this weird, like, five-day period where we thought that this dude, this, like, total – what is it? Pretty woman, like, come in and chop it up, break it up. You know, dude was – but anyway, it didn't happen, so.
Some total just, like, Wall Street private equity guy was going to come in. We were, sorry there, Jonathan. We ran the numbers.
Yeah,
and,
that was it, and it did not happen. So, anyway, I just wanted to clarify that. Okay. Because I can imagine your readers going, well, wait a minute, but they were sponsored by Cervelo in 2012. Yeah, it did not happen. It did not occur. So it was bought by somebody else, and they were very nice.
Okay.
Back to your question. So, you know, sugar daddy is one thing. A government entity is another thing.
Yeah.
You know, a sort of a packaged sponsor is another thing. So if you want to boil it down, I mean, we could go down, you know, government, Lotto, FDJ, Astana. I don't know what you call Katusha. Is that, that's like...
If any of our listeners are from Russia or Kazakhstan.
I mean, it's just an extremely wealthy individual.
Yeah.
Right. So, BMC, extremely wealthy individual. Sky is a bit of a mystery if it's, you know, if it's like British Federation money or if it's Sky, or if it's James Murdoch sort of like twisting. I mean, I don't know that one. Orica Green Edge is some Orica Scott is some Orica Scott money, a lot of Jerry Ryan money, and some support from Australian Federation. So the number of teams that are existing strictly on a commercial sponsorship model without, something like that in the background, it's not very many.
Right.
Very, very few. I think, quite frankly, the best examples, because the cost model makes more sense, are the French pro continental teams.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause your French pro, like Direct Energy, to me, those guys, they're operating half the budget as a world tour team.
Right.
They are guaranteed to go to the Tour de France. They are a national company, doesn't do business outside. I mean, that's a good model. They're always going to nail that. Now, so people say, well, then why don't you become pro-continental? Well, I can tell you that. Because we wouldn't get invited to the Tour de France. We are not French. ASO does not think, hey, wow, that guy JV, he's awesome. We really like it when he bashes us in the press.
Totally. Let's get JV over here. He's always such a friendly voice to what we're trying to do. And
right.
When we accidentally make a rule change that screws over half the peloton.
So that's the best examples of commercial models are those teams. And I'm sure that Direct Energy probably gets great ROI on that investment.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they don't have to send a team to all these other races. They don't have to have the infrastructure able to do a triple program all the time. Chapeau. Of the World Tour teams, very few are operating on a strictly commercial model.
I think about that through the lens of the American continental and pro-continental teams as well, because, I mean, you know, here we are at the Tour of California, and there's two continental teams, and the conversation I've had with both continental teams, it's a little bit of both. Although with Jelly Belly, it's a straight marketing play. You know, they sell a lot of jelly beans, and I think... I mean, Danny runs that team out of his garage and is very budget conscious and has done a lot with a little for a really long
platform.
Time.
Yeah. I mean, this race is the platform for them every year.
Right. And then all of a sudden it's like, if you shut off access to a race like that, you know, then that's the proverbial getting shut out for the Tour de France for someone like you. So it does seem like it can exist in the lower levels of cycling so long as you have that one invite that like keeps you alive.
Right.
This sounds very stressful. It makes being a journalist actually seem really like secure in this profession that we have.
You know, from our perspective, large global sponsors aren't going to, you know, they're not going to sign on for the figures that it requires to do a World Tour team unless you're guaranteed a slot in the Tour de France. So, And when I say guaranteed, it's guaranteed at the time of signing the contract. So being a pro continental team is it's essentially not an option. So you have to scale up to be a World Tour team in order to be guaranteed that if you want to approach, you know, global companies.
Okay.
What else? That's, I mean, I have been in many discussions with ASO where they argue this, where they're like, yes, but we always invite the best pro continental teams and so on and so forth. This is, you know, okay, fine. Let's say that's true. It still doesn't matter because you have to sign the contract with the sponsor 10 months before the Tour de France happens. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have a guarantee, it's just, well, wait a minute. So what are we buying? And this goes back to the whole discussion that I know I've had over and over and over and over and over and over again ad nauseum, is that...
Again, the Finch is very excited about this next discussion we're having.
Yeah. Ad nauseum is that you want to get this fundamental financial instability out of the equation. The easiest fix. Everyone's sort of digging around for, you know, alternative revenue sources, and that's great. All that stuff is great. But the easiest fix is just... You know, these are the 18 organizations that do the Tour de France, period.
Right.
Boom. Done. And therefore, you can go out and sell that. And, you know, and you want a new sponsor wants to come in, or a new owner wants to come in. Some people always say, well, what about if there's a new owner group that wants to come in and do it their way? Fine. They can buy one of those 18 franchises. No problem. But if you want, you know, to build equity in an organization, and the way you build equity is being able to guarantee your revenue stream, and the way you guarantee your revenue stream is to guarantee entry into the platform that gives you that revenue stream. I mean, it's super simple. It's like business 101, but you know, but it's just not something that I think ASO will ever do voluntarily.
Well, what about a happy business story for cycling? I'm really interested in what's going to happen with this Hammer Series race. It sounds like something that a lot of people have been working on. What are your hopes and ambitions for what comes out of
the Hammer Series? Well, it's trying to set up another platform, you know, a platform that's media friendly, that's, you know, set up for what the way people view things nowadays, mm-hmm. in sort of, you know, short snippets of action. And being able to analyze data from those short snippets of action, I mean, a lot of other sports lend themselves much more easily to that than cycling does. And the Hammer Series is trying to kind of change it over that direction. Urban formats, placing the races at times of day where, you know, people will have free time to actually watch the race, whether it be live stream, television, you know, live, whatever. It's set up, you know, the Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, like Thursday afternoon, Friday afternoon, Saturday, Sunday format, set up in a building format, meaning that the race builds on itself, as opposed to sort of the stages aren't necessarily correlated to one another, so on and so forth. So yeah, I mean, it is a great concept. It's obviously in its infancy, but I think long term it's got legs.
I think the Villainese need to have an event like this of our own, where we could have a Giro d'Italia downhill road race, where you just, you know, kind of shoehorn the rules in at the last minute, and then a fixie crit like the Red Hook Criterium.
Yeah, exactly.
Stream the whole thing.
Pure entertainment.
Just
no
get on all the trends in cycling right now and sell some sponsorships to it. Get some some energy drink companies involved and just bank it that way. Now, I mean, Jonathan, you know, we've talked about this for years. Cycling is a difficult sport. I always tell people that between races, except for the Tour de France, races and teams, the resting state of a bike race in the United States is dead. The resting state of a bike team in the United States is dead. It's only by incredible amounts of effort and money and sweat and banging your head against the wall that these things are able to live. And I don't know if we're ever going to move away from that that model.
Yeah. I mean, I can tell you with it. People always ask me, you know, when do you start looking for another sponsorship? And I say the day after you sign the one that you just got.
Yeah, right.
Always. It could be a 3-year commitment. The day after, you're out looking for something new, because it's the only way that you'll actually give yourself the time to find it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's truly. When I describe to a lot of my friends that are in other businesses what we do, they're blown away. They're like, so basically you gather enough money for a startup, you're essentially in a startup phase, and you gather your venture cap money every year with the guarantee that those investors will not get their money back.
Oh, yeah.
And you do that over and over and over again, and you've been doing that for a decade. I mean, yeah. In my MBA cohort, it was, I mean, these people were, how do you, you know, can we hire you, please? Because all you have to do is raise that once for us, and we'll actually, you
totally.
Know.
Yeah, it's, revenue model, my revenue coming in is your money.
Yeah, yeah.
I spend it.
Right. So that is, yeah, I mean, that's a tough game. And listen, the races are not much different.
Well,
I mean, well, except the Tour de France, yeah, and then that's a whole different ball of potatoes.
Well, yeah. And they're just falling over themselves to share revenue with you guys too. You know, I mean, they just can't wait to cut up some of those TV rights.
Exactly.
And give them to you guys.
But here's the fun. You know, this is the funny thing about that is that. Well, I do think there should be revenue sharing. Obviously, model that out for a second. So, what happens if all the teams just get a $3 million check every year from ASO? And there's no other restriction other than, here you go, thank you. What happens?
Sky has still has 20 more,
right?
25
million
more. So
where does that money go?
Where does that
$3 million go for every single team?
Yeah, it goes just right back into rider salaries and infrastructure
not even
salaries.
Riders, plural. Really, it goes into a bidding wars
right.
between like about 10 guys.
Right.
That's where it goes. It's basically just shot right out the rear end. So if you I mean, you could say it's like Chris Froome, Peter Sagan, Alberto Conta. I mean, whoop, it's gone. Like the revenue sharing is gone. And ASO know that. You have to. Revenue sharing has no point from a stability standpoint.
Unless you have a cap.
Unless you have a cap. Yep. Exactly. Yep.
Yeah. Well, Jonathan, we really appreciate it. This is some good insight. Again, I had read that Wall Street Journal story and had questions, so many questions, most of which was, well, I'm going to be seeing you guys next year. And so I'm glad to hear that we will.
Well, I hope. Like I said, it's a decision every year, but so far we've managed to stave off the wolves every year.
Okay. Well, thanks again. And we'll be seeing your team out there throughout the week.
Thanks.
Okay, well, that was Jonathan Vaughters. I mean, I'm glad to hear that he sounds fairly confident this team's going to be around. I mean, like he said, every cycling team, especially his, I mean, it's tough out there. It could die at any moment.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like he's fairly confident that they'll be around
for a
while.
It's a scary biz.
Yeah.
Yeah. But if you're not fairly confident, you'll be around for a while.
Mmm. Ooh, boy.
What a segue.
If you're not confident in your ability to be around for a while on this earth, we think you should go check out our sponsor today, Health IQ, because they are the life insurance company for yep. healthy, fit people yep. like us.
Think of your family.
Yep.
Yep. Yeah, so basically, we've said this a number of times already, but this is a company that does life insurance for those of us who are healthier, and so we are less likely to just kick the bucket, and so the rates are lower. So yep. you should head on over to healthiq.com/Velanews.
And I want to thank Health IQ and the other sponsors that have come on board with the Velanews podcast. You know, this is a project that we started several months ago. We have a lot of fun with it, and some sponsors are starting to, you know, thank us for the work we've done, I guess. Mm-hmm. Anyway, they help us make this project come to life, and we appreciate them. So, Kaylee, before we get out of here, we need to wrap it up with a couple quick questions from this week. You know, the question that I keep coming back to is from your unserious questions. you know, Mario Cipollini this week had some really bad stuff to say
just
about
so
the Giro.
Mean.
So mean. Hottest. Like a kind of a mean take. His take
flaming
was...
Flaming take.
Flaming yep. take from the lion. He basically said, "What the Giro, the riders of this generation are—they're
like robots.
Robots,
they're, you know, programmed by technology, and they just look at their power meters, and they're very boring."
Yeah,
basically.
And the question was, "Well, okay, if you were a piece of technology, what would you be? You can't say a large AC unit that has podcast gear mounted on it in the back of a shooting gallery shed." Because that's too close to home right now.
Since we're on race right now, one of my primary preoccupations is finding good coffee.
Mm.
And so I think I'd be some sort of mobile drone coffee maker machine. And so I could just, you know, wake up in the morning and a drone would just come over and give me my morning Joe.
I would, if you were that piece of technology, I would buy you immediately. I would buy you immediately. If I were a piece of technology, this is a little bit more just like in line with my personality. I would be a application that breaks your bicycle and your bicycle gear.
Fred doesn't get on all that way with technology, just in general.
It would be some type of like app that you mount to your bike, and then all of a sudden like spokes start breaking. And you get a lot of flat tires.
How many times this week have I said, "Oh, Fred, you just had to do this," and you say, "What? I don't know what that is."
Wait, what do you mean they have 11 speed bikes now? That's insane. We would love your feedback on what we talked about today. You can email us at webletters@competitorgroup.com. We'll also post links to the stories we talked about today on velonews.com. Subscribe to the Velonews podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play. And while you're there, please leave us a comment and a rating. Become a fan of Velonews on Facebook.com at facebook.com/velonewsmagazine. And follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/velonews. The Velonews podcast is produced by Velonews, which is owned by the Competitor Group. Thoughts and opinions expressed on the Velonews podcast are those of the individual. As always. Mm-hmm. And as always, we leave you this week with the Brooklyn Boogaloo Blowout playing the Bernard Purdy Purdy Classic Soul Drums.
Soul Drums!